Okay. You're good to go.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, good morning. Wait, it's not morning. Good afternoon. I'm so sorry. I keep forgetting that. I'm going to share about Ruth in a minute, but before I do that, I'm going to hopefully encourage you for a second before I talk. We sang that song, King of My Heart, today, and I think the last time I heard that song was about 4 years ago, the last time I sang it, if I remember right. And it was the time when I was discerning whether or not to come and move to Scotland, and I was visiting. I had a two-week holiday from the church I was pastoring, and I took the 2 weeks not to go to my church. I went to another church, and they sang that song, and there were some funny things going on. There had been some major changes, and suddenly there was this new program, and I was trying to decide if I should apply for it. And so this first Sunday, I got up, and there had been an ice storm in Vancouver. And kind of like here, the wind and water moved sideways, and so I took this road called River Road along this river. And as I drove in the morning, the whole thing was frosted over. Like every tree was blasted with ice. It was like, it was magnificent. There was fog and water, and it was like being in a fog, right? And so I got to this church, and it was an hour from where I normally live, and I was worshiping, and it was a great experience. Sang that song, had a deep sense of God leading us, and trying to decide, do I apply to St. Andrews or not? And I come out of the church, and I turn right, and I'm waiting at a stoplight, and the fog clears, and I'm at St. Andrews Street. I think, oh. Maybe this is part of it. And so the subsequent week, the week between then, I dig in, I write my application, I say, I'm gonna go for this. And the next Sunday, because I had 2 weeks off, the next Sunday I'm going back, and I drove the same road, but this week it was perfectly crystal clear. The fog was gone, the ice was gone, everything's out of the way. And that was the beginning of a process of really a long time discerning whether we're gonna do it. And so I'm not done encouraging you because I wanna continue this. It took like, usually, you know, you apply for things and you find out within a couple months, 3, 4, 5, it took like 7 months for them to respond, which is extraordinarily long time. And then at the end, I was, the only reason I applied is because they had these amazing scholarships, and I was accepted but not funded. And then I thought, well, now what do I do? And so my prayer had been, Lord, should I do this or not? And my prayer became, Lord, you've been my admissions counselor, now you need to be my financial aid counselor. If you're going to make this happen, you have to fund it. And so we began praying, my wife and I, and within 2 weeks, two things happened, which are pretty cool. One was that they arranged a half-tuition scholarship for me from the school. And the second was that I called my best friend, who I hadn't spoken to in a year, and said, hey, mate, I'm going to ask you for money. And he said, great. He says, we've been praying about how to give away money that we have. And he and his family have funded almost my entire degree in addition to this. So within that, over the past 3 years now, God has provided for every financial need we've needed in this time. And so the reason I want to encourage you, because I'm reminded by the song, is that you know what? You don't have to be a pastor to pray big and see God do stuff for you. You can just ask him and then wait and see what he's going to do. And so if you're holding on to something small or something big, I want to encourage you to seek him and let him do stuff, because he's done stuff for us and it's been cool. And you know what? He's been good. He's been really good. He's been better than good in these things. And so I'm reminded of that this morning. That's it. Mini sermon over. Now let's turn to Ruth. I'm told you're looking at character and mission in different figures. And so this week I was given Ruth, and I'm really excited. I love the book of Ruth. I think it's some great stuff. And I think that this book is a fascinating character study, but I think it's probably not in the ways with which you're familiar of thinking of Ruth as a character study. So I'm going to try and draw some fresh insights from the text for you today. Maybe these aren't fresh. Maybe you've known them all along. And if that's the case, I'm just late to the party, and that's all right, too. So we're going to do a few things. I'm going to tell the story of Ruth. We're going to pause and talk about the super story, because there's a story behind the story. And then we're going to draw a few lessons from character and mission. And we'll have to see how this all goes together. So let's talk about the story of Ruth. Ruth is Old Testament, comes after the book of Judges. It's kind of pre-history stuff. It's an interesting little one-off story. You know that in our Bibles, things are arranged according to how they're ordered. But in the Hebrew Bible, this Ruth is contained with the other small books. She's got a different kind of space. But we read her as history. In the story, you get this Israelite woman named Naomi and her husband Elimelech. And there's a famine in the land of Israel, and so they leave Israel for nearby Moab, just across the Jordan to the south, bordering on the Dead Sea. If you've got your Israelite map in your head, here's the Anyway, here's the land of Israel. It's over there, right? That's where you're going to go. By my left elbow is Moab, okay? There's questions that aren't answered. Why is there a famine? Sometimes in the Bible you get specific events and weather and history that are tied to like obedience and disobedience, and there's no reason for this famine given. It's just a famine. We don't know what's happening. Why are Naomi and Elimelech leaving the inheritance? That seems odd. Why would they walk away? What's going wrong that they think that, oh, things will be better where God isn't Lord of the land? This seems like a strange choice. And while they're there, it tells us that their two sons marry two Moabite women. Okay? So their sons get married off to two Moabite women. And we should make some notes about Moabites before we go on. Number one, they're not considered very good people in the Bible. I wanted to read for you right now. This is Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 and 4. This is what Moses says. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of these people, Ammonites, Moabites, can enter the assembly. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. Now, I mean, I don't know how much you know about like Middle Eastern memory, but it goes back a long ways. And if you are a desert people and you refuse water to someone, that's like wishing them dead. And so the Moabites were mean. And the Israelites are committed to remember that. And then, they hired Balaam. You guys remember the story of Balaam and his donkey. And the donkey ends up being smarter than the prophet. And then there's a moment of asking, who's the ass here? Is what you have to ask at that story. Okay? And so Moses commands them not to let any Moabites in. But we get more. In the book of Zephaniah 2:9, we get more. God says this, therefore, as I live, declares the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab will be like Sodom, and the sons of Ammon like Gomorrah, a place possessed by nettles and salt pits, a perpetual desolation. The remnant of my people will plunder them, and the remainder of my nation will inherit them. Now, this is later than Ruth, but the sentiments are the same. How you feel about Moab? This is a place that is to be considered like Sodom, a wasteland, destroyed, utterly God-forsaken. Part of the reasons for this probably are because the Moabites are worshippers of an ancient Near Eastern god named Chemosh or Chemosh. Any gods are kind of a dime a dozen. They're all kind of the same. Sky, wind, fire, light, sun, you know, powers and forces, and they demand things from different people. Apparently the worship of Chemosh involved blood sacrifice. If you look up 2 Kings 3:27, the king of Moab offers his son as a burnt offering. Okay, so he murders his own son in offering to Chemosh. So this is not an uncommon practice, we're to assume. And consequently, because of this kind of worship, the Moabites receive frequent condemnation of the prophets. And if you just search for Moab in books like Jeremiah, Isaiah, or Amos, you're going to get some pretty intense condemnation of Moabites. So, on the whole, we get this idea of Moabites being not terribly good. And then we get Elimelech and Naomi marrying off their boys to two of them. And that seems a bit weird. Seems like the kind of thing maybe you shouldn't do. Of course, both boys die. And we're left with kind of the pregnant, like, did they die because they were married? You don't know. It doesn't tell us. We can speculate all we want. They die. And then we hear that the famine ends. And then we hear that Naomi is going to return to Israel. And there's two daughters-in-law, one Ruth, the other one Orpah. And if you think Orpah looks like Oprah, you're right. Because when Oprah's mom picked a Bible name for her, she misspelled it. And so Orpah is Oprah, and that's... Okay, anyway, so there you go. This is maybe not like one of the Bible names you'd pick normally, like Dorcas. People don't name their kids Dorcas anymore. And anyway. Now, Ruth promises to stay, and after Naomi urges her to leave, we get the most famous verses from the book of Ruth. I'll read them for you now. It's Ruth 1, 16 and 17. You're probably familiar with this. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. It's a beautiful passage, one of the most lovely phrase sets in the Old Testament. It's great. It is common to read this as verses about friendship and loyalty. It's a great friendship verse, right? Two people partner together for life. Sometimes I've heard it read as a verse about marriage. Couples have this read at their wedding. Where you go, I will go. You know what? your God will be my God. It kind of justifies missionary dating. You guys know anybody who do missionary dating, right? Okay, don't worry about that. But we should note that, in fact, it is a verse about honoring one's parents. Ruth's promise here expresses a deep affection and loyalty to her mother-in-law. And if you will, this is a clear articulation of filial piety. That's what this verse is about. Let me read it again, and you think about this in terms of parents now. Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." This is about honoring parents. I think that's interesting. Now, we have no evidence that Ruth is familiar with the Ten Commandments. They're not directly referenced in this passage. And yet, for me, I can't help but think that the phrase, "honor your father and mother, that it may go well with you in the land which you are about to possess," appears to be lurking in the background here. That Ruth's loyalty to her mother-in-law is the doorway into long life in the land. This seems to be a riff on that commandment. And to put this even more succinctly, and as a hint of where we're going to go at the end, the doorway to Ruth's redemption seems to come through obedience to the fifth commandment. Her way into the kingdom is through this. She doesn't even know the commandments, but she obeys it. Interestingly, we're not going to go there right now, but Romans 2:14 says that when Gentiles obey the law, they become a law unto themselves, nodding to the role that people have when they even unknowingly follow parts of the kingdom and what this means for them. And I wonder if there's some stuff there that's worth thinking about. So they return to the land of Israel, and Naomi changes her name to Mara, which means bitterness. So she's had a bitter life, and she says, "I'm going to be called Bitterness now." Imagine, I mean, that's kind of emo, isn't it? "Call me Sadness," right? And, you know, you say that to your friends. And it's noteworthy also that the rest of the text, the author of Ruth, the guy, whoever wrote it down, doesn't change her name to Mara, just keeps calling her Naomi. So this is her perception of her time, and the author keeps it. There's a strong chance that the name Mara is related to Mariam as well, and also therefore the name Mary, which means that Mary is a common name, is bitterness. Which probably, as far as I understand how naming conventions work, some of the most popular names in the New Testament are Mary and Judas, right? There's like four Judases and there's like eight Marys, right? There's a ton of them. And Judah, of course, is praise. It's the praise of Israel. And Mara is bitterness, a sense of longing for redemption. So you name your kids after what you're missing and what you want. And so this is one of the reasons maybe this is popular. So they're back in Israel now, and they're still poor. Their situation hasn't changed. They've lost their land. They've lost their ability to produce from their land. And in a real way, the famine that precipitated their leaving Israel is still in effect, except now there's a famine in their personal lives as well. And Ruth and Naomi have really no economic future. The barrenness of the land is now barrenness kind of in their bodies. Legally, Ruth can stay until Naomi has another kid. That's probably not going to happen. And the kid grows up, and then, I mean, there's some weird conventions about how you preserve family lines, and this seems unlikely. And it does seem like a uniquely hopeless situation. So Ruth and Naomi are desperate. However, in the background, there are provisions of the law that are going to make a way for them. And so we're going to read something like Leviticus 19, 9 and 10, which is going to tell us why the law makes a provision, where Moses, again writing, says, "Now when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God." Imagine you've got a plot of land. We'll just pick, you guys are my plot. Hello. Right? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, we've got 15 units of field, right? And the commandment is that when you're harvesting, you leave an edge that you don't take so that poor people can come and gather food. And you just count it as like, no, this is not mine. This is for the land. That's what you do. Or if like you've got fruit trees, and one of the easiest ways to get fruit off of trees, right, is just to knock the tree. Right? You're going to gather some and some's going to fall on the ground. He says, what falls on the ground, you leave it. And the poor follow behind you and pick up. So there's economic provision for people who are poor in the land. They can take what they want. You should note that there's no moral constraints laid on the poor. Leave it for the really good poor. Right? Or leave it for the poor who pass the holiness literacy test that I've got, or Leave It for the Poor who've memorized Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. You know, just, there's no provisions for that. It's just no. When you have what falls to the ground and what's on the edges of your field is not yours. Which might suggest in modern practice that when you have pocket change, it's not yours. When you get change from making a purchase and you're walking down the street and someone hits you up for it, it's not your money. Right? Maybe there's some practical ways that we could do things like this and think about this. So anyway, this is a commandment we have. This is a way that people do this. And so this appears to be what's going on. Boaz is honoring this. He's got fields, he's got money, he's got wealth. He's not taking from the sides of it. And so Ruth and Naomi can survive. Additionally, in addition to provisions for the poor, there's explicit provision in the law for the stranger. And now we get a passage like Deuteronomy 10, verses 17 to 19. This says this, "For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who does not show partiality or take a bribe. He executes justice for the orphan and the widow and shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. So show your love for the alien, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt." So within Israelite mindset is always the memory of our time as the oppressed in Egypt. We were strangers and aliens, and we needed help at that time. And therefore, you better not forget, when you go somewhere where you're comfortable, that other aliens need help. You can't forget that. It's part of who you are. And if you do that, you're in massive trouble, says the Lord. Once again, there appear to be no moral conditions offered for the alien. It's not the good alien. It's not the nice alien. It's not the alien who looks like me. It's not the alien who's passed a health check, or whatever we want to pick for them. So you need to show hospitality, and hospitality laws are hugely important. So, what do we get? We get Boaz, a law-abiding Israelite. Boaz, on the lookout both for the poor in the land, Naomi, and the stranger, Ruth, the Moabitess, who's an outsider. And Boaz is paying attention. Now, you know, he may have his eye out for Naomi's daughter-in-law. I mean, Ruth apparently is an attractive woman. He's got his eye on her. He's like, oh, okay, this could be interesting. And he pays special attention to Ruth. Well, Naomi hears about it, and she comes up with a plot. This is a weird plot. Naomi says to Ruth, "Ruth, I want you to get dressed up. Okay, put on your makeup, do your hair, everything in order, wear your best. I want you to go to the threshing floor after the harvest, so there's going to be a party, some drinking. I want you to uncover his feet, and then I want you to listen to Boaz and do whatever he says." What is Naomi thinking? What kind of hookup metric is this? It's very strange. Well, I should point out that once again, Ruth obeys. And this appears, she's fulfilling the fifth commandment. She honors her Naomi as her mother. And she goes along with it. Boaz is proved honorable, and then he doesn't do anything. He redeems Ruth, and then he redeems Elimelech's land according to Hebrew practice at the time. He completes all things formally to make sure it's all upright, and then he marries Ruth and preserves Elimelech's inheritance among Israel. And it's funny because the story says that he fulfills Elimelech's duty, but actually Boaz is the one who gets named as the kind of hero of the story. And the story fulfilled, the last words, Ruth becomes a great-grandmother to King David. So King David's great-grandmother is one of these awful Moabites, right? Which probably shouldn't be the case. So there's some weirdness there, isn't it? A final key passage is Ruth 4, 14 and 15. "Then the women said to Naomi, 'Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today,'" redeemer Boaz, "'and may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Ruth fulfills filial piety better for Naomi than if she'd had seven sons. And in a patriarchal, male-dominated society, this is a pretty huge compliment. This is a massive elevation of who Ruth is. She's not just a woman. She's also an outsider. And they just said, she's better for you than seven sons. And it's her loyalty and her expression of that obedient loyalty that gives her this position. So some brief comments. So this is the story of Ruth. On its own, Ruth is simply a great story. It's a great read. It's short. It's fun. It's got all the bits. It's got some adventure and some tension and some romance. It's great stuff. It's got a fascinating snapshot of ancient culture and values, like trading your shoe to seal a deal. That's fun. Don't you think we should bring that back? You have to trade a shoe whenever you make a major deal. No? Some of you want to keep your shoes. That's all right. I think it's a lengthy riff on the importance of the fifth commandment. In other words, that honoring your parents leads to prosperity in the land. This appears to be what's part of what's going on. There is a surprising and redeeming female narrative in the midst of male-dominated texts. We get a sense of this is a picture of what godly womanhood looks like, and she's not an Israelite. So there's something, there's maybe a hint of like, hey, if the pagan woman can do it, how much more can you? There's probably something there. And yet there's also a bigger story of redemption buried in the subtext. So this is the business of the superstory, and I want to highlight this for you now. I omitted a key passage when describing the Moabites, and that key passage was the birth of Moab, which is a terribly weird story in itself. And if you don't know it, prepare to be a little weirded out. We've already talked about Sodom and Gomorrah. You remember that Sodom and Gomorrah are wiped off the face of the planet and by fire and brimstone. And perhaps you remember that one of the inhabitants, Lot, was Abraham's nephew, and he escapes basically with the smell of brimstone on his clothes, barely gets out. And Lot's wife looks back. She gets turned to a pillar of salt. Lot gets out with his two daughters. And in the aftermath, the two remaining daughters think they're the last people on earth. And so they come up with a plot to get their dad drunk and sleep with him to preserve the family line. This is their deal. You can read it. It's in Genesis 19, verses 30 to 38. So they do this. One night, the daughters get him drunk. So the older daughter sleeps with her father. It says that he doesn't know what happened. Okay, he was so drunk, he didn't know what happened. The next night, it's the younger daughter's turn, and they pull the same stunt again. They both become pregnant. The second daughter gives birth. They name the child Ben-Ami, father of the Amorites. And when the first daughter gives birth, they name the child Moab, father of the Moabites. So Moabite origins are kind of weird. Now, you get some funny stuff like this, and is this just kind of slander, like kind of cultural slander, like, well, your father. I mean, this kind of, you can say mean things, but this is the story we have in Genesis. Now, the connection to Ruth may not be immediately clear until we unpack some of the weird hints that are buried in the text. So the first of them is this. On the night that Naomi sends Ruth to meet Boaz, it's a harvest festival, and he's been drinking. It's party time. And you drink your fill and celebrate. It's a season of austerity. It's seen as a season of wealth. There's been famine. Now there's harvest. He's gonna feast, as everyone else is. Ruth 3, verse 7, the first part says, when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. He's like, look at all this food. We're going to eat for a while. He's a little tipsy, and he's like, that's it. I'm going to lay down and buy the food, right? So he's feeling good. In other words, I think that it's when Boaz is well drunk from the festival that he goes to sleep. It's beginning to look a lot like Lot all over again, isn't it? And so second, we get this strange set of instructions from Naomi to Ruth. She's to get herself all dressed up, then go to find Boaz, to note where he lies, and then to uncover his feet and lie down. Now this part won't make much sense unless we realize that the words uncover the feet in Hebrew are a euphemism for uncovering all of it. It's not just the feet that are uncovered, it's all of Boaz that has been uncovered. To uncover the feet is a euphemism for hiking up your robes to do your deeds. Right? You've had to uncover your feet to do that. And so, Naomi's advice begins to look a lot more salacious than it appears on the surface, doesn't it? Ruth, I want you to go and proposition Boaz when he's in a morally compromised position. It's possible here that Naomi intends to get Ruth pregnant and trap Boaz. It's possible. Which would be a kind of repeat of the Lot and his daughter story. There's no hope for us in the future. Let's get him drunk, and we'll make this happen, and that way we'll have a baby to go with these things. It's possible. And Ruth goes for it. Again, obedient. And she came secretly, 3:7, and uncovered his feet and lay down. So at this point, things could go very badly. If we have the narrative of Moab's wicked creation in the back of our minds, then it looks like the whole thing could go pear-shaped all over again. But where Lot was so drunk that he didn't know what he was doing, Boaz remains self-possessed, noble, a man of character even when inebriated. And I think that's one of the main points of this story, is that Boaz keeps it together even when potentially compromised. And he acts righteously even when no one's looking. It's quiet. He's by the grain heap. No one knows what's happened. Boaz has the rights to do whatever he wants with this poor woman right now, and he doesn't. And I think that's important. The links between the creation of Moab and Ruth's redemption, I think, hint at a much bigger redemptive story. And so where Lot's unrighteousness created an enemy for Israel, Boaz's righteousness will redeem an enemy. So let's come back to character and mission. I think the story of Ruth offers us some fascinating, unexpected insights into character, and I just want to tease out a few of them for us now. The first of these is to note that the dictates of the covenant are what invites the stranger into the kingdom. Our covenant dictates, our laws are the things that invite strangers into the kingdom. And so in order, Ruth's gateways to kingdom life are, for example, the fifth commandment. Ruth has a pre-existing piety. She's got things that are good about her, and those things, where they align with the gospel, become worked on, or with the covenant, become worked on. Ruth's gateway then is second, the care for the poor. There are systems of protection for the weak that become places where she also gets called in. And then Ruth's third gateway is Boaz's dignity and honoring of the law. Boaz, as the chief representative of the covenant, has the way to either make access for Ruth to enter in or to exploit her for his benefit. That seems to me crucial. It suggests that we shouldn't look to Ruth chiefly as a model for our personal character. Ruth isn't a model for our Christian personal character. Now, there's maybe elements of it. Ruth's obedience to the fifth commandment, if I'm right in that, she's a model for us in that. Wow, if Ruth can do it, then I should do it. I should be honoring my parents a certain way in these things. And she may put us to shame in that. But actually, I'm inclined to argue that the main reason we should look to Ruth is that she's an example of the kind of fruit we should expect when we, who are in the kingdom, live out its ethics appropriately. If we're obedient to the commandments and dictates of the kingdom, then there should be Ruths in our midst who are being attracted to those places of goodness that are in the kingdom. We should be looking for Ruths as fruit of how we live out the kingdom life. And so the presence or absence of Ruths becomes confirmation or criticism of how we're living out these things. I wonder if this is the case. Ruth can also help us to see how it is that when we encounter outsiders to the kingdom of God, we need to work with the piety they have. Sometimes we approach people who are strangers to the kingdom and we kind of start with the negative first. We start with their flaws and the things they have to work on. Oh, this guy's drinking, or this guy's smoking, or this guy's running off his mouth, or these people's divorces, or this person's abusive relationships, or this person's economic life. We could pick anything you want, or this person's excessive wealth. And so we focus on the negatives, when maybe, if Ruth is our model, we should be looking for where is this person showing a piety that aligns with what we believe already? And how can we partner with their piety? How can we major on the goods? It's a little too easy for us to become critical and hunt for the criticism rather than becoming affirmers and looking for what's good in these people's lives. The gospel doesn't always have to begin with condemnation. It can begin with affirmations of the good that's in people. In the same way, when we meet a righteous Hindu or a Buddhist or an atheist, we can partner with what's good in them already. This suggests that one way we can approach people outside our faith is to approach them looking for the positives. I think that's true. So that was number one. The first observation is that the covenant invites the stranger into the kingdom. We have to pay attention to that. The second, however, is that covenant abuse destroys strangers, while covenant allegiance on our part blesses them. If we become covenant abusers, we will destroy the people who are on the fringe. And if we become covenant honorers, then we will incorporate people who are on the fringe. It is not difficult to imagine if Boaz had taken advantage of Ruth. It would have been immensely destructive. Just another narrative of loss. It's not hard to imagine because it's easy to remember how many ministers and ministries in the news have abused this ministerial power. They're not living out the covenant. But because Boaz honors the covenant, Ruth gets to live and she becomes a blessing to many. In fact, because Boaz honors the covenant, Ruth's obedience blesses Naomi, her parent, with long life in the land. They all live long. They literally live happily ever after because of a covenant obedience. This suggests to me that the chief character to whom we should look for inspiration is Boaz. If we're in the covenant and we're in the kingdom, then Boaz is our model. Boaz, who cares for the poor, who obeys the laws concerning his economics and the stranger, and above all, is someone who is righteous even when potentially compromised. Now, Boaz, it says, it suggests, is not an outward follower of the law. He has it inscribed in his heart. It's inside him, so that his circumstances don't change his obedience. Boaz doesn't just observe the letter of the law. He's keen on its intention. And if we're keen to be like Boaz, then our personal commitment and our communal commitments to honoring God's laws can be a key way that aliens are brought to the door and then become family and then bless us deeply in return. I think these are places where we get really confused. And maybe Boaz also helps us to see how it is that we get confused between piety as self-development versus piety as mission and evangelism. I think my personal morality is just my personal development. I'm going to be more like Jesus. I've got 8 Jesus points, and next year I'm going to have 9 Jesus points. And I'm going to be more and more until I've got enough points to cash them in, I don't know, Jesus games. I don't know how that works. As opposed to seeing, hang on, my piety is for your sake. And not just for your sake, but for the sake of people who don't know Jesus. And maybe beginning to see holiness not as constraints, but holiness as attractiveness. I think that's part of it. I think we also are confused between piety as something like obedient action toward others versus piety as personal morality. If I think of piety as just my conduct versus piety as how I am to be obedient toward you, I always have the other person in mind when I'm choosing pious actions. I think that's part. Boaz can help us to see that as well. And then lastly, Boaz might help us to understand Jesus' command from John 13, where Jesus says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you. In this way you should love one another. By this all men will know you're my disciples, if you have love for one another." It is in our treatment of one another that we manifest the kingdom of God. It's not my holiness. It's not my answers to prayer. It's not your holiness. It's not how you fight the fight. It's how we fight for and love one another. Although that could be fun too. So let's pray about this and then worship some more. Jesus, I thank you for your word. I thank you for the book of Ruth. I thank you that texts are so fruitful and are never, they reward repeat readings and visitations and give us fresh ways to come to you and see you. Lord, I don't know where this group is in terms of their covenant obedience and in terms of their sense of where they are with you, Lord, and where they are with each other. But I pray that where they are strong in the kingdom already, you would strengthen them even more and pour out your blessings again and again in their love for each other, in their sense of your spirit, in their approach to others who maybe are on the fringe. And would you work through them, Lord, to make those people who are on the fringe to become friends and then families and then blessings, deep blessings. And these things I ask in your name, Jesus. Amen.